Welcome to Think Big with Dan and Qasim. Join host Dan Melnick and Qasim Masood as they explore big ideas, limitless possibilities, and engage with visionaries, entrepreneurs, and thought leaders who dare to dream big. Get inspired, motivated, and find practical tips for personal growth. Think big, dream bigger, and ignite your potential.
Welcome to Think Big with Dan and Qasim, and our guest today is Clay Abair. So Clay, if you want to go ahead and introduce yourself, tell us where you live and what you do for a living.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I live in Austin, Texas, and what I do for a living is help people answer the question, so what do you do for a living? That's the main keynote speech that I give. I help individuals and brands better explain what they do. So getting clear on their story and then how and where to tell it. So it starts at the perfect intro and really gets into the perfect brand, which is sort of marketing and branding consulting, helping people figure out the strategy to grow their company. And then the perfect calendar is kind of back for individuals again of like where you spend your time, how to do more of what you love and less of what you hate. Because I think to me at the core of personal development, you know, Tony Robbins and all that stuff is like, if we can do more of what we love and less of what we don't love, to me, that is kind of like turning the screw or turning the dial to a happier life. It's often not about people sell their companies for all this money and then they wonder why the next morning they're sad or they're not fulfilled. And I think it's because they didn't put on their calendar what they want to do that day, you know, and with who and where and how often and things like that. So I think the calendar is an interesting frame to do that. So, yeah.
Awesome. So how did you get the idea to go ahead and start this business?
Yeah. So the perfect intro thing. So I'll back up a little bit. I spent 10 years at Accenture doing corporate consulting. Accenture is the largest consulting firm in the world. I think they still are. And it was great. It was a great place to start your career out of college, work hard, you know, late nights, you know, work hard, play hard with the client kind of thing. Eventually the work got to be a bit repetitive for me. That's kind of how Accenture is as big as they are is repetitive work. We implement Oracle, we implement SAP, you know, certain kinds of transformational type of projects. To me, I'd done enough that the content got a little bit boring. 2003, I was about halfway through my career there and I found they were calling my name. I was flying in between two projects and I ran into Hudson News in the airport. I had to grab a book quickly. So I ran to the, you know, new releases or business section. And there was this strange looking sort of purple book that had kind of a cow print. And I'm from Wisconsin. So it kind of spoke to me. I was like, what's this doing in the business section? I don't know. Good enough. I'm got to board my flight. And it was Purple Cow by Seth Godin. So I finished it on that flight, short book. And it sort of blew my brains against the airplane window, like Quentin Tarantino, you know, I was like, wow, this guy thinks about business innovation and marketing. And like, it was the first business book I had read that wasn't just business information, but actually spoke to me like the way that I see the world. So then I went home and subscribed to his blog and bought some of his prior books and just started inhaling all that. And it wasn't at that point where I was like, I got to leave Accenture. I basically was like, I need to bring this kind of thinking inside Accenture because I thought our tagline at the time was innovation delivered. And I was like, we do the delivered part really well. We don't do the innovation part really well. Accenture is not known for thinking of new strategies and inventing Uber and things like that. And so I thought I found the book that would help us do that and think that way. And I sort of butt my head up against the wall for a few years trying to get Accenture to think more innovatively. And when I realized that they weren't going to quite go as fast as I wanted to, my role there was like, if I wanted to do that, you know, full time, Accenture was not the place to do it. So in 2008, at the end of 2008, Seth actually blogged about an opportunity to study with him in his office. The title of the blog post is called, If You Could Change Your Life, Would You? And I applied for that program and got in. There was kind of a crazy Hunger Games interview process and a wild application. And I was fortunate enough to get into that program. So that's when I left Accenture, spent 6 months with Seth Godin. Obama's first day was our first day. Spent 6 months there and then kind of learning from the master. And then I literally like control alt delete started my career over at zero. Everything was zero. You know, no clients, no money, no health insurance. And, but I had learned what I needed to learn from Seth and, I've been doing that for my clients ever since. So that's kind of the thing that's evolved. The perfect intro specifically was 2013. I was at a conference and I completely blew my introduction to this guy sitting in the back. The guy sitting in the back was Matt Mullenweg, who invented WordPress that powers a quarter of the internet. And I realized that I never wanted to introduce myself that poorly ever again. So I kind of solved it for myself, taught it randomly to a couple entrepreneurs, and it seemed to resonate. So then I kept sort of dipping the candle in the wax and teaching it to more people and more people. And eventually that became kind of my fastball keynote that I do the most right now.
Where in Wisconsin are you from, by the way? Because I grew up in Chicago. I went to college in Wisconsin, as you can probably tell by my accent.
Nice. That's funny. My fiance is from Chicago, and my dad lives in Madison now. I grew up in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and yeah, my dad lives in Madison. My mom still lives in Eau Claire.
Yeah, I went to UWM for college.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Both my parents went to Marquette, so just up the road.
Awesome. So in terms of starting your marketing career, I mean, it's funny, you know, I know it's something that, you know, it's very challenging, right? Jumping in, starting your own business, like not having health insurance. At that time, what would you say was your biggest challenge when you actually jumped in and got started?
Yeah, I mean, the Seth program created this, if I back up a little bit, 2007, 2008, I was still doing my job at Accenture. I'd managed to convince them to let me work remotely, support this group of partners. So I was, to be honest, I was sort of doing my day job, you know, with my left hand while I had a different monitor up looking for marketing jobs. And ironically, I hadn't done any marketing. I just had read Seth Godin's everything he wrote to that point and had tried to bring that inside of Accenture with minimal success, a couple little projects here and there. But in general, I sort of used the analogy. I felt like I had this magic canoe paddle and it would do amazing things, but I was standing on the top bow of an aircraft carrier that was like way too far off the water. And so, you know, your magic canoe paddle is not super valuable. So yeah, it was that program was sort of the 6 month transition period. Even after the program, I got to admit, like, it was still pretty scary to like hang out a shingle. As much as I was like excited and revved up from the 6 months of this program and sitting next to Seth for 6 months, it was still really scary to start everything over at zero. And there was a moment where I was like, should I go back to Accenture and try again to bring, even knowing that was the wrong, you know, move. And a friend of mine had a great, short conversation with me. He said, well, you have some savings so you can pay your bills for a little while. And if you don't get any clients, let's just say worst case scenario, you hang out a shingle, start doing marketing and branding. Say you don't get any clients, say everything falls apart. He goes, in 6 months, do you think Accenture would take you back? Like 6 months after the 6 months? I was like, yeah, of course. They love the work that I did and whatever. And they would definitely take me back. And he just looked me dead in the eyes and he goes, so what's the problem? Like, why are you not taking this swing at this thing you want to do if clicking reverse on the podcast of your life a couple clicks is totally possible in Accenture, allowing me to come back in where I left, you know? And when he said that, it was kind of one of those things where it's like, it's obvious once you say it that I wasn't burning the ships, so to speak. You know, it's a popular term in entrepreneurship of like burn the ships. Maybe, but maybe you don't have to burn the ships. And maybe knowing that you could go back allows you the headspace to go forward.
Yeah, it's funny because I work for a consulting company that was bought out by PwC, and it's the same thing. I think we're talking about these, you know, big four top consulting firms. At the end of the day, they're charging your client or their clients lots of money and taking a pretty big cut. So yeah, when you can cut out that middle person and do your own thing, that makes a huge difference.
The day that I knew I was going to leave Accenture, when it was the day that I saw the spreadsheet of what they were charging the client versus what they were paying me. And granted, like, you know, there's a brand and you're selling a much larger project and you're not, but that percentage, when I saw that, I knew that I was not long for that firm.
Yeah, 100%. So what would you say makes somebody successful in branding and marketing?
Understanding humans. Branding and marketing is not about Facebook ads. It's not about Instagram reels or everything's over on Clubhouse now. Now Clubhouse is dead. It's not tactics and strategies and tools. It's understanding humans and how they want to feel and status and all those levers, and then giving them products and services that really to them become stories that make them feel the way that they want to feel. It's really that simple. One of my favorite examples of this, I love Yeti coolers, and I don't love them because they're a $300 cooler. You know, like Yeti built a brand around a story that your cooler should be cooler. Before Yeti, the Coleman 5-day extreme that worked fine and kept your food cold and whatever. If the three of us went camping, pretty sure the Coleman would keep the food cold long enough for us to get back to civilization. You know, we weren't that far off the trail. And Yeti sort of created this story that, oh, it keeps the ice cold for 15 days. Has any of us really needed that? You know, the 5 to the 15, maybe. But more importantly, the story that Yeti created is I'm willing to have this luxury product because I'm a certain type of person. I'm the type of person who is outdoorsy or invests in, you know, it's the masculinity and the traits that Yeti confers by owning a Yeti product. The cooler is really just the symbol of the masculinity and the identity. And yes, it's a better cooler, 100%. It's a 3 times better cooler. The Coleman costs $33. The Yeti should cost $100 if you're charging for a better cooler. So where does the extra $200 come from? It comes from the brand and the story and the identity and the masculinity, because let's say my neighbor buys a brand new F-150 and I'm still pushing a 7-year-old Chevy Silverado, and he gets to brag and rev up his F-150 and, you know, make snide comments to me about my old truck. What do? I buy a Yeti cooler and I'm like, yeah, nice Coleman, Jeff. Put it in your, you know, put your Coleman in your F-150. It's like a win. that psychology, right? And that's just one example, right? Another one is Yeti. It wasn't their tagline, but they seeded a little YouTube video. They put a bunch of steaks and blood and meat into a cooler and then into a Yeti and then cinched it down. And then they put it out in the woods in Alaska, and a grizzly bear came up and tried to paw at it and get inside of it, and it couldn't. And then the money shot of the video is the grizzly bear sulking away because he couldn't get into the cooler. Now that speaks to outdoorsy and masculinity and identity. And, you know, it's almost like built Ford Tough, but for coolers. Now, the funny thing is Yeti is based here in Austin, Texas, where I'm based. There is not a grizzly bear within 1,000 miles of Austin, Texas. That is not a problem that most Yeti customers run into often, but it tells the right story, right? Just like in every Super Bowl ad, what's the thing they do in every Super Bowl ad, Super Bowl truck ad that never happens in real life? They drop an iron I-beam from 20 feet, you know? They're like, Dan, let her go, break the chains. And then the thing drops in the concrete. And we all sit there and, you know, sip our drink. And we're like, yeah, that's what people do with trucks. That's not what people do with trucks. The new $80,000 Ford F-150, you polish that. And if it branch scratches it, you know, you take it in and you keep it pristine. You're not like the guys who go to the job site and are dropping, you know, they really don't drop concrete in the truck. They put it in the truck, but they know what truck to buy. The commercial is not for them. The commercial is for the skinny accountant who feels like less of a man, but if he buys the F-150 and now I get the cooler and so on and so on. So I love brands and stories. And what makes somebody good at that is it's not tools and tactics. That's the last mile. And of course you need a way to get the message out. But if you nail the psychology, another story I love. Have you guys heard of Last Crumb Cookies?
I don't think I have, no.
So it's interesting. They sell cookies. They're $160 for a dozen cookies. And they mail you a box that's this big. And the cookies are like this big. So like the cookies are delicious, but you don't need a huge box of a dozen massive cookies for yourself. So what are you actually buying? Well, you're buying being the coolest person at the party everyone else brings an $80 bottle of wine, you bring $160, you know, birthday present or whatever. That's all anyone at the party talks about for 2 hours is, oh my God, look, it's huge. It's this thing. It's this experience. Each cookie feeds 4 or 5 people. And so it's not Chips Ahoy. You're not buying a cookie. You're buying being the coolest person at the party. And the cookie is just the experience that allows you to get there. You're buying being the thing that everyone talks about. Now, is that for everybody? No. Most people want to go to a party and have a safe bottle of Pinot Noir and hand it to the host, and they want to blend in. But there's certain people who want to show up at the party and be like, Clay's here, or, you know, whoever, you know, and create a conversation with that box, right? That, and then 2 of the people that eat the cookies have that experience. And then for the next birthday party, they order a box of Last Crumb. So brand is what allows you to charge $300 for a cooler that's functionally $100 or $160 for a box of cookies that's really not cookies at all.
Yeah, that makes sense. So Clay, what's the role of technology in your business right now?
What technology do I use in the business? I'm a big fan of I'm a technology geek. I feel like the arc of apps that people use as they become more on the sort of productivity spectrum, it starts low, goes high, and then sort of settles about halfway, which is like I went from too many apps and too many things in the dock and apps and tools. I love apps and tools, but to be productive eventually you kind of settle down to the core one. So obviously Zoom, I use Descript for podcasts, my own podcast stuff, and then chopping up clips and all that other stuff, transcribing. Yeah, I love all these tools. Readwise, I'm trying to use Readwise Reader to put all of the information that I consume away from my email inbox. So my email inbox is communication with clients and everything else, because, you know, even though I have a secondary email address, I've used the primary one too many times to sign up for interesting things, interesting newsletters, lead magnets, et cetera. And so of the 100 emails I get every day, maybe only 10 of them are relevant, but as a result, I get behind. And so I'm going to, I think, hire a VA to take everything that's not an email from a human and put it in Readwise Reader. So I like that. What are the other tools? I use Things for like a personal to-do system. Apple Notes is very underrated. I was a late adopter to Apple Notes maybe 3-4 years ago. And man, I'm telling you, Apple like figured it out. They're like, no bells and whistles, Keynote, Notes. Freeform is a really cool new app. Have you guys heard of Freeform? It's like on the Mac. Yeah. It's built into the Mac operating system, just like Notes or Keynote, but it allows me to do visual mapping of like, just think of like colors, shapes, boxes, work, you know, user flows, everything else, stuff that's like not as complex as Visio or Lucidchart. But if I want to like make a visual model of something and make it kind of colorful and show this and shapes and triangles, Freeform is built into the Mac and it's great for that. So yeah, those are some of the tools I use. Figma, Drafts for writing, Google Docs, yeah, all of it.
What about AI? Is that, you know, part of your tech stack right now? And if not, what do you think AI could help solve for you that you're not using it for right now?
Yeah, that's a great question. I actually have a speech called What AI Is Not Good At Yet. I'm a huge fan of AI. I try to tinker with Midjourney because I like creativity, but I'm not the best. I'm still trying to get better at Midjourney. ChatGPT being like a words guy, I love using ChatGPT as like a writing partner and a brainstorming partner. I don't think it writes really excellent, compelling human copy. Or if you know how to prompt it in order to get it there, you're pretty much a great copywriter already, right? The gist of that talk that I give is everyone, you know, ChatGPT came out and everyone said, you can fire all your copywriters. And so I took some of the projects I've worked on and the brands I've built and said through ChatGPT a prompt and said, you know, write copy for a $7,000 jacket. Or I did Last Crumb, like we talked about, how do I sell a dozen cookies for $160, right? And they're like, make them delicious. And so, you know, it's not wrong, but it's not deep enough. You know what I mean? So, but I like those tools. I am using it in my workflow. I'm trying to remember more when I am writing a piece or outlining a piece to use it as a tool, right? I don't think you can put in 5% effort and get 100% of a quality piece, depending on the level of creativity, right? It's a little bit like Google. If you're better at using it, it's going to be better. And obviously it gets better all the time. But it's not writing copy to sell $7,000 jackets right now.
No, I think also it's like if you have a good copywriter, to your point, and if, or for example, if you're able to use data and machine learning from the data of that company, they could write good copy. But it just, you know, OpenAI pulling random stuff from the internet, you know, that's not going to be the most effective way to talk about a specific brand.
Right. And I'm a pretty good copywriter, but the best copywriter is your customer. And that's the thing that most people don't do, especially most sort of technical people, developers I've found. They don't like, you know, there's a reason that there was a phrase in lean startup world called get out of the building, because it would go from like idea, problem, let me throw some code at it. And the answer is, if you're building an app for moms with strollers, you know, I used to mentor lean startup guys in our startup weekend in Microsoft in New York City. On Saturday, we'd go there, or, you know, Friday night, they'd have their ideas, and Saturday morning, they'd start building it. And my job was to gently not throw them out the window, but like point to the 9 moms who had strollers in Central Park and be like, go talk to them, go listen to your customers and use your iPhone and record what they say and figure out what their problem is. And often, as good a copywriter as I am, often your customer, they might not say it exactly how you landed on the website, but the way they articulate the problem that you're solving for them is often the best copy or the best raw material for the copy that you can come up with. So I always tell people, before you hire an expensive copywriter, go talk to your customers, record it, transcribe it, polish it. That's what ChatGPT could be good for, is like take a bunch of customer research, data, interviews, transcription, and then say like, you know, prompt it like, imagine you're Don Draper from Mad Men, turn all of this data into 15 taglines for our company, right? Like that kind of thing, ChatGPT is pretty good for. But people just, you know, it can't help you get out of the building and go talk to your customer. A new tool won't do that. But if you're willing to do that, then it can. I always say, like, it's like the sharpest knife in the world. And if you're a sushi chef, you want to have a very, very sharp knife. But having a sharp knife doesn't make you a sushi chef.
Makes sense. So if somebody was going to work with you, what type of clients do you look for? Like a, you know, a certain revenue metric or industry? Like what's like, I guess, the best type of client for you?
Yeah, that's a great question. I work with a lot of brands and startups. I basically have three offerings. One is the speech, right? So if there's a conference that's got, you know, often it's corporations or associations or typically the people who put on the conferences. I also do a lot of masterminds. But if I'm giving a speech, that's that. If it's a consulting project, I sort of work in two ways. One is kind of like a 2-day intensive, perfect brand sprint. And I use a framework I use called the 10 magic marketing questions. So that's like a 90-minute Zoom call, 2 days on site. So I go to their place usually if they have, you know, an HQ, and we bring their marketing team and anyone that needs to be involved. And I basically lead the session on the whiteboard, go through all the questions, and then a follow-up 90-minute Zoom call. And that whole package is like 25K. And then the one other way that I've started to work with companies is similar kind of work, a little bit longer term consulting. But basically, once they start thinking of selling their company, what I've realized is this branding, positioning, messaging, storytelling, right? It's critical in the beginning and it's important in the middle. But when people go to sell their company, let's say you've built an agency to whatever size and you're thinking of selling it, that's typically when people, they either stop telling stories or they forget about telling stories, or they just get so darn busy thinking of selling their company that they forget about positioning and messaging and storytelling and branding and all that other stuff. And so what I found is like coming in, the ideal client for that is someone who's like, okay, I've built this thing. It's a certain level of success. I'm going to sell it. And I work with a business partner on this. And our criteria is like, your goal is to sell it for more than $10 million. If you're selling for less than $10 million, it's great, but it probably doesn't work with our model. And the model is we do three parts: strategy, story, and sale. So strategy, what are the rocks in the business or the big things where maybe a slight pivot could help a lot, or any, you know, holes to plug if it's an app or things like that. And then what is the story? Simultaneously, we'll work on like, what's the story and how do we align the story of your business with the market and what the market wants to buy and certain clients want to buy. And then the sale, working through the sale, and then also all of the sort of founder therapy, you know, leading into it. So we avoid as much as possible the whole, you know, you sell your company, you assume it's going to be ringing the New York Stock Exchange in a ticker tape parade, but it actually feels like you sold part of your soul and nobody called you that day. And, you know, so you have the biggest number you've ever seen in your bank account and you're actually really depressed. That's mitigatable to some extent if you can explain it. Most people are surprised by that, and that's why it feels bad. If you know it's coming and you can say it, then you can have conversations earlier on. And then some of it is selling at the right time frame and to the right company, right? Maximizing the dollar amount is not always the right thing. It's better to sell your company for $50 million to the perfect partner than for $52 million to some firm that doesn't get it and they're going to make your earn out a nightmare.
Makes sense. So if somebody watching this wanted to reach out to you, do you mind sharing your website or best way for somebody to get in contact with you?
Yeah, for sure. My name is Clay Hebert. The last name is spelled H-E-B-E-R-T. So if you Google me there, you can you can find the website. Social media, come say hi on Twitter. My DMs are open. Feel free to do that. Or yeah, my website is just clayhebert.com.
Awesome. Well, Clay, thank you so much for your time. Yeah. It's a pleasure. You know, hopefully we'll chat soon in Austin. Yeah. And yeah, thanks again.
Of course. Thanks for having me. Take care.
Thanks. All right. Bye.
Bye.